But the last couple of Sabbaths I've spoken about Noah and this worldwide flood. In fact, only eight people, Noah, Mrs. Noah, because I never did find out what her name was. Does anybody know what name Mrs. Noah was? No, you don't. You never will until the kingdom of God comes. Maybe that will be one of the first questions we'll ask. What was your name, Mrs. Noah? Because you will meet her at that time. At least I hope you will. She had, and they had, three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and we all know about them and their three wives. And that was it, eight people that were saved in that ark. And you wonder what's going to happen when the world comes to an end again. Now, God promised he's never going to bring a worldwide flood to destroy mankind. Again. He didn't say it wasn't going to bring worldwide fire or destruction, but at least we won't have to worry about getting our water wings out again. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the post-Noah, post-flood world. In fact, I think, was that the topic you're going to have in one of the Bible studies? Did you say that? Oh, that was just pre. Okay. Well, this time I want to talk about today is the post-flood world. You might think, well, that started out pretty nice. Yeah, eight people. Eight people out of millions of people who perished, and only eight people left. Now, if you were one of those kids, and I use the expression kids quite often to mean just young people, and I have no idea what ages they were, and I'm sure they were, I could look it up in my chronology, find out exactly what age they were, but the important point is that they had to do something about the post-flood world. Now, you come out of an ark, you've been afloat on that for a year plus, and you look around and you see nothing but a little vegetation growing. What would you do? What would be the first thing you would do? Now, I'm not asking this rhetorically, meaning I want an answer, a verbal answer. It's just something to think about. If I were in that situation, I would logically do two things. I would build some kind of housing, so I'd have some place to put my head when it started to rain again. You really would wonder what you were thinking about if it was going to rain again. It's all, no, again? But it did. We don't know when. But I'd build a house or a home or a tent or do something to have something over my head. Wouldn't you do the same? What's the other thing you would do? You would look around for something to eat. You would plant some crops. You begin to grow a few things for food. Because, you know, it takes a year for most food to grow, and you'd have to have something. Maybe you have to forage for a while. Maybe God will provide. Maybe they had a bunch of stuff in the ark they brought out to last them. I don't know. They probably had a lot of feed for the animals. What'd they do with them? With all that food? And they gave it to the animals? What? I don't know. There are so many things that happened right after the flood with Noah and his family, it's hard to describe them in a sermon. You just have to imagine. Maybe someday we'll be able to ask, well, what did you do? And they'll tell you exactly. Now, along with all what man was doing at that time, there was another person who was pretty busy. And that's Satan the devil. Now, he had been very effective in his deceiving mankind. Nobody was converted. Nobody was called. The whole world was deceived. The whole world was dead. How effective was Satan before the flood? Very effective. He let everybody die except, well, God let everybody die except the eight members of the Noah's family. And then he got busy. He says, well, I got to start deceiving man again. They think they're in good shape. They've got lots of land. They've got eight people and millions of acres. What are they going to do? How am I going to deceive them? And I want to talk a little bit about that today because he is very clever. And it didn't take him long to start deceiving mankind. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that Noah's three sons really were unconverted. So he had a lot of humans. He had three daughters-in-law. They were not converted. He had humans who were easy targets, ripe targets to be deceived. Some of them were greatly deceived. We're going to talk about that a little bit today. Because he, Satan, and his henchmen were very busy deceiving all mankind. It didn't take them long. And you're going to read, I want to read a bit, little bit about Genesis 11, but I want you to open your Bibles to Genesis 10, and let's talk about some of the things that happened right after the flood. But let's read a few verses. Genesis 10, and we're reading verses 1 and 2. These are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. The sons were born to them after the flood. So their families began to grow. And they had, as a grand total, those three boys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and the three wives, mentions 16 names, to be specific, 16 sons. And I don't mean to say they didn't have any daughters. Daughters were not mentioned. Are daughters important? Absolutely. Without daughters, they wouldn't have any families. So I speculated, and I think I may have mentioned through this to you before, if Noah and his wife had three sons who then themselves had 16 sons, how many daughters did they have? Well, the Bible doesn't say. But you know the worldwide population has always been pretty evenly divided between men and women. If you have 16 sons, chances are they probably had 16 daughters. But why don't we just assume, for the I like to assume things. You know what assume means? No, I better not tell you what assume means. Let's assume that only 10 of those boys and 10 of those girls got married to produce 10 families. Is that a reasonable assumption out of the 16? Yeah, I think that's fairly reasonable. Then that means they maybe had, if they had, say, 10 sons and daughters, maybe they had 10 children each. Each of those 10 marriages produced children. Maybe there were 10 sons and daughters. Or 10, technical term is 10 squared, 10 times 10. And then they, in turn, had marriages among themselves and with their aunts and uncles and who knows how many other combinations they had. Maybe they had 10 more sons per person. That would give you 10 times 10 times 10 or 100 children in just three generations. Two, if you want to look at it by the powers of numbers. But 3, 10 cubed, is 1,000 children. Well, then there's 10,000 children in the next generation. Then there's 100,000 in the next generation. So it wasn't too many years before you had a lot of kids, a lot of young people. And the one thing I noticed about young people, and I think you'll all agree with me, they're ambitious. They're hardworking. They're not like me, old, tired old guy. We tend to do a lot of things. Youngsters never get tired of playing ball or, you know, you name it, playing with their hobbies, building things. I remember growing up, I used to love to build things. And I hated to have to come in when it got dark. But that's what Mom and Dad said, come home at such and such a time. And now, didn't your mother and father not tell you that as well? Sure they did. They knew that it wasn't safe to be out at night. But here, by the way, I've noticed, though, that things are getting worse and worse and worse. And good old Cleveland sure has their share of problems. And I'm not saying that Utah doesn't have their problems, because they do. But I say Ohio has their problems. So there were a lot of people that were growing. And you can, well, you can read some of these verses. Verse 6, it says in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 6, a lot of things happened. Let me read that verse. I'll find my notes here. Sons of Ham were Cain and Mitzrayim, Put and Canaan. Now those of just one family had four sons, the sons of Ham. Now we all know that these people migrated. You might say, well, really, where'd they migrate? Well, the Bible doesn't clearly define it, but most people who study this kind of thing, Dr. Hay did, and other people in the Worldwide Church did, seems the reason that Mithraim was really people who went down into the land of Goshen, because that's where the pharaohs were called sons of Mithraim. Phut really populated most of Central Africa. Canaan, you all know about him. He was up there to meet Israel when Israel came out of their captivity, came out of the Red Sea. So you know they occupied Palestine. And then Cush himself became the father of the Cushites. That makes sense. Cush, Cushites. Or Ethiopia. So this really, excuse me, one continent of Africa was where most of the sons of Ham migrated. Now, only reason why I mention that about Africa is that is probably the poorest continent, people-wise, not wealth-wise, but people-wise, on the face of the earth. More war, more tragedy, more sickness, more deaths, more war, more tribal fighting than any other continent on the face of the earth. I really feel sorry for the Africans. Who would like to take the job of going over to Africa and straighten that nation out? Don't raise your hands. You might get picked. They need a lot of help. They need to straighten out their attitudes. They need to learn about God's laws. They've never known about God's laws. And when Egypt, one of the great powers in Africa, finally was decimated and came back from that decimation after the flood, and, well, I should say after the days of, go a little bit further than that, after the days of Moses, and they rose to power, and then they went down, they rose, and finally they just disappeared. And that whole nation has been sick and sicker all the time ever since. It's a very sad story when you read about it, but it happened. Verse 22. Talks a little bit about the sons of Shem, were Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. The sons of Aram, and mentions a few. It shows some of the population growth. Doesn't identify everybody. But if you want to study genealogy, you can study the genealogy of Noah's family. It's all defined in the Bible. It doesn't tell everybody, but it tells a lot. It makes an interesting study. But let's go on down to chapter 9. Verse 24. Arphaxad became the father of Selah. Selah became the father of Eber. And two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Now, what does it mean the earth was divided? What happened in Peleg's day that is not really defined in that verse, but is defined in chapter 11, great detail. The languages were divided. Languages were changed, and it has a lot to do with chapter 11, which talks about Babel. Babel has always meant confusion. I noticed that one of the books long time ago that I obtained from my library on data processing, when they referred to the languages in data processing, were like Babylon, Babel. They were confusion. And it was very confusing. But think of this as people all united in one language. We don't know what it was for sure. But they got together and they decided to do something as a nation, as a group of people. And you read about that in chapter 11. And that's a very interesting chapter, because you find out some of the things that happened to the Tower of Babel. I'm going to go back and read one verse in chapter 9 that precedes this. Verse 18. Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now you all, I mentioned that enough that you should all have that memorized, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Doesn't necessarily mean that Shem was the oldest. That's one thing you have to understand when you begin to study genealogies. You think, oh, maybe that wasn't the case. Well, actually, it turned out that Japheth was the older one of the three, the oldest. Then came Ham, the middle kid, and then came Noah, the younger one, Shem. He was actually the youngest one. But he's mentioned first because he was the righteous one, and that happens quite often. God sometimes will list people in the order of their importance in the Bible and importance in righteousness. Verse 18, we have the three sons mentioned. In 19, these were the sons of Noah. From these, the whole earth was populated. You came from Ham, or Japheth, or Shem. All of you did. All of us did. We don't know which, because we lost that genealogy a long time ago. And it is amazing, God knows, though, every person. Every person who's ever lived. What kind of a mind can remember those things? He knows all the genealogy of all the animals. We're lucky to know the genealogy of our family. We know the names of our brothers, sister, mom, and dad, and sometimes people can tell you a little bit more about grandchildren or great-grandchildren or great-grandfathers, grandmothers, but that's about the limit most people have study of genealogy. Verse 20, then Noah began farming and planting a vineyard. Well, after the flood, he planted crops. He planted vines. And what is it specifically referring to here? He planted a vineyard. That's a grape vineyard. He grew grapes. And grapes are not the easiest things in the world to grow, by the way. I get a kick out of... My wife had one of these little redwood tubs, you know, that you put plants in. She said, oh, well, I got a little patio in the back here, and I'll put my little pot out there, and I'll plant a few things in it. I'll plant some tomatoes. She likes tomatoes. I like tomatoes, too. So do deer like tomatoes. Came right up there and nibbled them right down to a nubbins. And those guys, I say that to generally, they're all mostly all females, but there are many males there, too. They came up to, they come within 10 feet of our back door, and they get up in the bird feeders and eat all the bird food, too. I mean, these guys are greedy little boogers. They just really love to lap up all the food they can be given. Remember, our next-door neighbor feeds them pound after pound of oats and other crops, and even has a little place for the animals to come up, and we've seen as many as 18 head of deer right there. Sometimes even a couple of buck. And, of course, they're running around and chasing each other. Now, by the way, not the bucks necessarily chasing the does. It's maybe sometimes the does chase other does. They get up there with their hoofs and say, I don't like you, and they get up there on their back legs and strike with their paws. And I think, wow, these guys are pretty rough. Well, they're doing that because there's a lot of good food there. But they get tired of that, and they got to go over and eat the bird feed, too. I think, my, oh, my. I know my wife and I watch to see what the squirrels would do. Well, they can't get up to the bird feeder because it's on a steel pole. So we're safe from them. We got another bird feeder about the end of the property on the east side, yeah. And it's up only about this high, and it's right near a lot of brush, and so the squirrel can come up on some of the branches and get out there. But the bird feeder is an interesting little bird feeder, because if the squirrel gets on any of the part of the bird feeder, it's on little slides. And the doors are all locked shut when they get any weight on it. And my wife demonstrated to me that this little bird feeder has the little movable sides that come down and close the doors if any weight gets on it. So the deer try to nibble, they don't have much luck, nor do the squirrels. And we do have some bird food once in a while. Although, guess what? Deer come around and smell it. And I don't think they'd get anything. All they can do is put their mouth up there and maybe tongue out a few little pieces. I don't know what they tend to get really well fed. And the squirrels are the fattest little critters you've ever seen. They just love all the food that the neighbors put out for the deer. They not only love it, the ducks from the nearby pond come waddling up in single file, about 30 of them sometimes, and they get up there and quack, 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 and make a horrible racket, jump up on the bird feeder, or in this case the deer feeder, and they gobble away. Then all of a sudden, something happens, they get scared, they all fly off back down to the pond. It just, like clockwork, you can say, well, you know, watch it, pretty soon now they're going to fly off, and sure enough, they all fly off. They get frightened by something, I don't know what it is. But they tend to get down there. Well, look here, here's Ham. Now, we just get back on the subject. He plants a vineyard. Verse 21, this is all post-flood world now. He drank of the wine, because grapes just naturally ferment, turn into wine. They get all that sugar, gets converted to alcohol. And what happened to poor old Noah? He became drunk, uncovered himself in his tent. He was so drunk that he fell asleep on his bed naked. You might think, wow, what a mistake. Yeah, Noah did make a sin. He committed an error. It was wrong for him to do that. It goes on to show you what happened here. Doesn't tell everything that happened. Ham, the father of Canaan. Now, why does it mention Canaan? We haven't even talked about the children yet. But here it talks about Ham, who was the father of Canaan, because it was Canaan who did something pretty bad to his grandfather. Oh, let me see. I got to stop and think of mentioning great-grandfather. I'd have to think about it for a second. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and he told his two brothers outside. That would be Shem and Japheth. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders, walked backward, covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness, which, of course, is all a part of the Old Testament law among children and parents to respect your mother and father and their privacy. So Noah woke, verse 24, from the wine, and he was dead drunk at this point before he woke up. He knew what his youngest son had done to him. It's referring not to his youngest son, but his grandest son, Canaan. Remember, that's right, it would have been his grandson. I'll get it straight. His grandson. I don't know. It doesn't say what he did, but he knew it was his grandson. And it goes on to condemn him. Verse 25, cursed be Canaan, not Ham, not the father, but the grandson. Cursed be Canaan, as servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, let Canaan be his servant, but may God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. So here was something that Canaan had done that's not even defined in the Bible. But it was something that was so bad that he was cursed for his entire life. He was going to be a servant to both Shem and Japheth. And people have wondered about this. You can read in any one of the books and describes critical commentaries or anything that describes about this event here, and it doesn't say what he did. And I've often asked, now, does anybody here know what he did? No, you only can guess. Now, wait a minute, you mean we can guess? He did something that would cause him so much pain and so much servitude to be a servant the rest of his life, to be cursed the rest of his life? That's a pretty bad sin, whatever it was. Yes, it is. It says, verse 28, and this is the clue you have, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. Flood came in his 600th year, and he lived 350 years afterwards, and he died at 950 years. Verse 29. Now, what was, what was the thing that Canaan did while Noah was drunk? He was probably a teenager. He may have been an older teenager, maybe in his young 20s. We don't know. It doesn't define it. But we know he did something that was so bad that he was cursed. The only thing we know about these verses 28 and 29, and this is all speculation, is Noah and his wife never had any more children. No more children, no more brothers and sisters. Three sons, married three daughters, three daughter-in-laws, but never had any more children. How many children did Adam and Eve have? Typical, they lived a long life. Well, 56 children, 33 boys and 23 girls. You know, I mentioned that before. That's what Josephus tells us. 56 children, and Noah and Mrs. Noah only had three boys. So, really, what happened? He lived another 350 years. Was he incapable of having any more children? Possibly. If something had happened to Noah that caused a curse upon Canaan, and that Noah could have any more, no more children. And I'm not going to guess what, even. Put in any kind of technical terms. It's for you to overcome your problems and get into God's family, and then you can ask him yourself if you got enough guts. Maybe that time you won't care. You'll just be so thankful to be in God's family, you really won't care. Excuse me for looking over here a little bit. Once in a while, I glance over there. I see that speaker and that little head there, and I think, is there somebody standing over there? You know, and I say, oh, no, that's not anybody. All right, so now we know a little bit about the family. They had a lot of trouble. Back to growing grapes. This is something you can answer. You can answer by raising your hand. How many of you have ever grown any grapes? I don't care whether it's wine grapes or juice grapes. You have, good. What is there about grapes that is so unusual? They grow pretty rapidly. What have you found out about them? You only get grapes on one-year-old crops. Branches that are one-year-old are the things that produce the grapes. They have to be pruned, or they become wild and tangled messes and they don't get any growth. But every year you got to go back there and clip off all the dead growth with where the grapes grew, and let new branches come out of the 1 year old. They produce the next set of grapes. So it's a long process. When in the world could Noah have done that where he could get drunk? Well, I've grown grapes much of my life, and usually you can't get a decent, really decent crop of grapes until grape plants are 8 or 9 years old, maybe even more. So did Noah, immediately after he got out of the flood, get drunk? He comes out of the ark and said, give me the wine, boys. No. He had to grow grapes, and that maybe took a number of years. It doesn't say that in the Bible. It doesn't tell you that. You got to use your head to reason. He produced enough grapes, so, to make wine. Maybe use the old foot technique of crushing the grapes out. Get the grape juice out, which, by the way, naturally have the ability to ferment. You don't have to put a lot of fermenter in there. Now, if you're growing grapes, you need to, if you want to really have control, you have to put some kind of yeast in there to really give them a little extra help, convert all that sugar into alcohol. But it shows you that time passed and could very well have been a number of years before Noah got drunk. I don't know. I don't know how many years it was. I know that Canaan grew up, probably a teenager or in his 20s, for all I know. At least he was old enough and smart enough to know that he should not be fooling around with his grandfather, which he did. And he was cursed for it all of his life. Genesis chapter 10, verse 8. Here's another verse I want to pick up here before we get into chapter 11. Cush became the father of Nimrod. Here is this famous person mentioned in the Bible, Nimrod. Got to realize he was the son of Ham. I'm sorry, the son of Cush, who was the son of Ham, grandson of Noah. So we're talking about Nimrod was the great-grandson of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. Nimrod was anything but righteous. He was a great-grandson. How long does it take for man to become corrupt and become a sinner? Not very long. Doesn't take too many years for you to go the wrong way. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of the kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne, in the land of Shinar. Now Shinar is where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers join together. It's where we modern day call Iraq. That was the land of Shinar. That's where they migrated when they came off the mountain Ararat, where the ark had landed. They came right down the mountains. They came into the land of Shinar, a natural place, wonderful land, plenty of water. There was one other place that was very famous for good crops, good water, and that was down at the Nile River in Egypt. And that's where the two populations grew in this country after the flood, the Nile River and the land of Babylon, or Euphrates and River, the two rivers of, what are they? The Euphrates and the Tigris, yeah, thank you, Tigris River. And there from there it says, from that land he, and the he is a questionable. Who is the he referring to? You might say, well, I guess that's referring to the previous verse. The one who did all this building and in the land of Shinar. He went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh, which was one of the great cities before, well, in the pre-flood world, post-flood world, excuse me. And Rehoboth, and Calne. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calne, that is a great city. Population was growing rapidly. And we've already talked about how this population, because of so many children, could have rapidly grown. But there was a problem. They had great ambitions and great ideas. And I want to leave Nimrod aside. I'll come back to him. But I want to turn over to chapter 11 of Genesis now and begin to read about that. Because here is one of the most amazing stories in the Bible. It's hard to believe. I still can't understand the power of God and what he can do. The whole earth used the same language and the same words. They were all of one language. Many, many millions of people maybe by now. We don't know. The second generation had 100 families, the third had 1,000, the fourth had 10,000. How many years was it before they had 1,000,000 of people? Well, there were a lot of people. In verse 1, it came about as they journeyed east, and then they went over east. I'm sure I'm not pointing the right way when I say east. It's that way, isn't it? No, it's that way. I always get confused. I have to think about it for a second. Came about as they journeyed east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. That was a natural place. Plenty of beautiful land, plenty of water. They could have all they wanted to eat and plant and sow and enjoy life. And they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, let's build ourselves a city. Let's go on and read that. Let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top shall reach unto heaven, and let us make up for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. They wanted to all be united, one big happy family. And they said the way to do that is we need to have a big tower that just goes way up to heaven. And we'll build it out of brick. And so they started this ambitious project. And there was that was the only thing they had to do. They had to grow food, enjoy food. They had families. They said, we can spend our time building a new city. What did they do? The Lord came down, verse 5, to see the city and the tower the sons of men were building. They said, what in the world are they up to? He was so interested, he said, I got to go down and look. And that's the thing about God. If he's not sure of the facts, he will come down and he'll look right at it. Think about that next time you make a little mistake, which you never do, of course. Right. God may be looking very closely. Moses said, behold, they are of one people, and they have all had the same language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing which they propose to do will be impossible for them. One language, united, and we're building a city, and who knows what else they were doing. There are a lot of speculations about all kinds of crazy things that may have happened back there. I don't know how much of it's true. Come on, or come, God said, verse 7, let us go down and there confuse their languages. So they may not understand one another's speech. So here are all these people busily putting up this big brick-built city whose top reaches up to heaven. And the speculation is at the very top there they were putting all kinds of symbols and things that were associated with the signs of the zodiac, which have always meant a lot to mankind. In fact, some of us once in a while will get out our newspaper and say, well, I wonder what Abby is saying today about me, or whoever is the columnist. I'll go down there, I'll see Leo. Where's Leo? I'm a Leo. You know, that just means I was born in July, that's all. And I'll read about what they say, and they're always so ridiculous. I'm sorry. Now, please forgive me if any of you are enthusiasts with that hobby. You go ahead and read it for your heart's content. Just don't bet your bank on it, okay? Because it may not come out exactly right. But let's see what happened here. The Lord scattered them abroad from there over the whole face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That's when the land got divided. We read about that in the days of Peleg. That's what the division is talking about. The languages were divided. One person was talking in German, was tun sie, or whatever it was he was saying, I don't know. And the other guy said, you know, say, and he couldn't understand what he was talking about. Parlez-vous français? Well, I can't speak any French. I can't do this, I can't do that. I know a couple of words of German, a couple of words of Spanish. What if everybody only knew their own language? First of all, I don't understand how God designed that. Changed their hearing. So all of a sudden, they all had vocabularies of hundreds, if not thousands of words, but it was in some strange foreign language that they understood and nobody else understood. What would the first thing they had to do? They had to hunt around for people who talked ways they could understand. So that automatically divided all these people into groups. And then what did they say? Well, we can't live with these people. Let's go to our own place. Let's go to it. And they began to migrate all around the world because they didn't know what else to do. They couldn't understand the Southerners. They couldn't understand the Northerners. They couldn't understand the Easterners. They certainly couldn't understand those crazy Westerners. So they said, let's go. They migrated. The Chinese all the way over to China. Japanese even further, all the way to Japan. Oh, that's why it's so interesting to study the Bible, because it gives you so many interesting topics that you would like to find out what happened. So here are these people going all over the land. Verse 9, therefore the name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the languages of the whole earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. And you know, you can't understand unless you really read some of the things like Dr. Herman Hay in his compendium wrote. He's got a lot of help from people who help him translate various documents. Found out that the very first hero of China was a black man, a person of the black race. And he said, this is really strange. Because from there, then all the people became sort of a yellow color, as we think of the Chinese as a yellow color. Forgive me. I'm just using these terms in generality. But you understand, here there were a lot of things going on in the world, but they always considered this black man, who happened to be Nimrod. Now, wait a minute. How does Nimrod get into China? He died in Italy. How did he get all the way over to China? In his 27th year of reign, Shem put him out of his misery. Assassinated him because he was such a deceitful, lying individual, and he was so disobedient to God. One of the acts for which Shem is, I think, considered a righteous man because he finally got rid of Nimrod. What was so bad with Nimrod, not because he went over to China, and he actually never did, his descendants went over to China. But what did he do? Well, first of all, who was Nimrod? Who was his father? His father was Cush. I'm sorry, Nimrod's father was Cush. I got that. Nimrod I'm talking about. Nimrod's father was Cush. Cush is the father of the Ethiopians. That's where that whole nation of people migrated in Egypt and then down south. Phut, one of the other boys, migrated into Central Africa. Mitzrayim into the Goshen. Canaan, you know about, he was in Israel, Palestine. You got all these people migrating all over the world, and they all speak different languages. And you wonder, well. Then in verses 10 on, it talks about all the descendants of Shem. Mentions them and takes you all the way down to good old Abraham. But that's another story I'm leaving for later. But I'm trying to concentrate on Cush and his son, Nimrod. Who was Cush's wife? That's the next obvious question we have to have. Well, the Bible doesn't say. I can say, I know. Yeah, I do. Her name was Mrs. Cush. Nobody can call me a liar to say that. Mrs. Cush. She had a lot of children, too, and mentions those. How many they had? A lot of children. I think it was 6 boys. I forgot, no more. I think it was more like 9 boys. Doesn't mention any of the ladies, but probably the same number of ladies as well. But Mrs. Cush and Cush had a son named Nimrod. And for many, many years, and I'm not sure that we really understand all the facts about Cush's life, but I know that he reigned in Egypt for some 60 years. And he spent a lot of his time in Shinar and the Nile. And at one point, he and Nimrod co-reigned. He co-reigned, and they built together the city of Babel. This was not a one-man project. This was Cush and his son Nimrod. And they worked really hard to make this great city so the people could look what their motive was. They want to see that city, and they'll bow down to me. They'll worship me. And that's what they did do. But at one point, Mrs. Cush got this idea of having a religion. Her name is commonly called Semiramis, or Ishtar, or Easter, modern English. And she began to build a religion. Strength of it, by the way, was on her son, Nimrod. Now here's where the interesting thing comes in. And if you ever have a chance to look at Hislop, Alexander Hislop's Two Babylons, you ought to do so. I got one of those books 40 years ago. And I said, boy, I can't even find that old edition. It was a really old book, hard to read. But I found that Barnes & Noble still carries three different translations, three different versions of Hislop's Two Babylons. So I bought one, the oldest version. It only cost $15-16. I figured this is worth it. And I read that book very faithfully, very carefully, because it is very heavy reading, not easy. A lot of words, a lot of expression, a lot of long sentences. You have to do a lot to dig it out, dig out the truth. But I went ahead with Hislop's Two Babylons because it talks a little bit about Nimrod. It talks a lot about Nimrod and a lot about Semiramis, a lot about Cush. And after they built this city of Babel and they spent all of 2 years building it, when God said, let's confound the languages. And they left off building the city. Here was an unfinished tower. They just walked away from it. But of course, this is what Herman Hay says. I don't know whether he's right or wrong. But it's a good possibility that Cush was assassinated by Nimrod, his own son. Now, why? Well, because they were so disappointed in this confusion of all these languages. Cush was called Mr. Confusion, is one way to put it, because of all the languages. They blamed it on Cush. Now, maybe Nimrod blamed this whole project on his father Cush, but in any case, the speculation by Dr. Hay was that he assassinated Cush. There's another reason. Nimrod also really fell in love with his mother. Now, it's not wrong to love your mother, but the way Nimrod did was very wrong. She married him. Semiramis married her son. Can you believe that? They merrily went on their life until Nimrod was finally put out of his misery after 27 years. Semiramis, the wife, was driven into Goshen for 30 years. So Herman Hay says. I haven't been able to get all the genealogies. I'm working on it now. Get all the books out that explain it. Write them down, all the references. While she was down there, Nimrod was dead now. She had relations with Asher. And she produced another child. And as Two Babylons mentions very carefully, if Semiramis was a white woman, which is the speculation, she had a white child through Asher, who was of the white race. So here was a white child born to Semiramis, whose name was Ninus, or Gilgamesh, in Shinar, who became a very famous person in his own right, but whom Semiramis cleverly explained, this is Nimrod reborn. This is Nimrod reborn. You should worship him too, just like you worship Nimrod. Now, why did they worship Nimrod? Because Semiramis came up with this idea of a false religion with all kinds of initiations and drink and sex and all kinds of, well, bad things going on. Bad rites, bad practices, to the point where even Gilgamesh at one point, or the descendant, was mentioned in, where is it mentioned I'll give you the verse and you can look it up. Well, my eye doesn't catch it. Be with me. See, that's the point. When you have your notes and you don't clearly mark them with a yellow pen, you forget it. I think it was in 2 Kings, and I can't even find it. Anyhow, he was referred to as Bacchus, or in the 2 Kings, he has another name, which all has to do with a lot of revelry and terrible things that were going on. But Semiramis also had a lot of contribution to mankind. She was the one, at least this seems to be the logic we come up with, that said, you know what you people need to do to protect yourself from the wild animals? Well, by the way, I haven't mentioned wild animals yet. There were a lot of wild animals then? Yeah. There were so many wild animals, they were destroying a lot of people until Semiramis came along and said, you know what you need to do? You need to put fences around your cities. Put a wall around your city. And every crown that Semiramis has is a crown that shows turrets around her head, because they wanted to thank her for saving their lives by putting up fences around their cities. Plus, Nimrod's called a mighty hunter. Why was he called a mighty hunter? Because he was famous for horse training. And he used as his animals to really drive a lot of animals into his traps, of all things, leopards. He trained leopards. And they're a very fast animal. So you get all this from Hyslops to Babylons. It's a very interesting story. And he destroyed a lot of wild animals. Bow and arrow, probably the spear. Long before they invented guns. But they had a lot of things they could use as weaponry. And Nimrod was the one who led the charge, so to speak, and saved a lot of people. He was the one that really gave Semiramis her authority and power. And that's why the people then really loved this religion. Because Semiramis really understood men and women love to adore or worship something. It might be sticks, it might be humans, it may be animals, anything. He says, I've got something for you guys you can really enjoy. My church, because we have a real simple initiation. You got to come in, get drunk, you got to have sex with one of the maidens, and then you I'll give you all the secrets about this religion. And they thought, this is wonderful. So that's what she did do. Of course, you know what happens then. Everybody gets violent and they go all around the world and they take their false religion everywhere. I want you to go to Revelation chapter 17 now. We're going to jump all over from Genesis to Revelation chapter 17. Because it talks in this chapter about this great religious system that Nimrod and Semiramis developed. Verse 1, one of the seven angels who had the seven books came and spoke to me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. And when the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, those who dwelt in the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. He came to me and he carried me away, the spirit, into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven head and 10 horns. Now, we all have probably studied this many times. Perhaps Mr. Watkins has even given you Bible studies on this. Maybe on the whole book of Revelation. It's a fascinating story. Woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a great cup filled with abominations out of the uncleanness of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great. That's where Babel started, Babylon. Mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered greatly. Goes on to talk about this great mystery that has confused the world. Now, what do we know about Satan? The primary thing that's talked about in Satan in the Bible, he's a great deceiver. He deceives all mankind. You know, you could talk to your mother, your father, your aunts, your uncles, people not in the church, and they don't understand a word you're saying, especially on religious topics. All of a sudden, the blinds get shut. They won't listen. The ears get plugged up.
They won't hear what you say. Satan has done a very effective job. He's deceived all mankind. Let's go on and read, beginning about verse 13. They all have one purpose. They give their power and their authority to the beast. They were waged in war against the Lamb. These are people who fight against the Lamb, capital L, meaning Christ himself. The Lamb will overcome them because he is the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. That's Jesus Christ. Those who are with him are called the chosen and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are all peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Well, isn't that really true of the whole world? They're just totally deceived. The ten horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the whore or the harlot and make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. This is not a happy ending for this great false church. For God has put in his hearts to execute the purpose by having a common purpose and be giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So you understand now we've got a great false system that's going to be destroyed. This is a terrible thing that's going to happen, but it's going to happen. And it was all started long ago by this woman, Semiramis, and her husband's son. The only way you can describe it, Hyslop's Two Babylon very carefully documents that. And has deceived the whole world. So where do you stand right now? You speak one good language, English. If you're really blessed, you speak a little bit of another language. And that's about the limit. How in the world are we going to warn the world? Is anybody qualified to speak in Spanish or German or French or Japanese or Chinese? I don't think so. We got a few foreign language aficionados, that's great. Well, we have a job to do, and that's to preach the gospel to the whole world. How are we going to do it? Maybe all we can do right now is pray that God will bring together all the things we need to do to get our job done, and then turn it over to the two witnesses. And maybe they're going to do like they did in the book of Acts chapter 2. They're going to speak in English. They think it's English, but the words are going to be translated in all kinds of languages. They're going to warn the world. They're going to warn what's happened, and the fact that we have got a chance to be part of the family of God and understand all the truth and bring all people into a happy relationship with God.